Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and we'll get a take on U.S. involvement in Somalia now through the lens of military historian Andrew Bacevich. His new book, called Breach of Trust, includes his perspective on how the Pentagon kept creating work for itself after the Cold War in the 1990s, at a time when there could have been a peace dividend of historic proportions, drawing down the military to pre-World War II levels. The U.S. intervention in Somalia in 1992 was one of its first post-Cold War missions. We'll talk with Andrew Bacevich in a minute, but here is a history clip of President George H.W. Bush in December of 1992 announcing the deployment of 28,000 U.S. troops to deliver food to Somalis at risk of starvation in a famine. The U.N. had been trying to do it, but had been blocked.
The U.N. has been prevented from deploying its initial commitment of troops. In many cases, food from relief flights is being looted upon landing. Food convoys have been hijacked, aid workers assaulted, ships with food have been subject to artillery attacks that prevented them from docking. There is no government in Somalia. Law and order have broken down. Anarchy prevails. One image tells the story. Imagine 7,000 tons of food aid literally bursting out of a warehouse on a dock in Mogadishu while Somalis starve less than a kilometer away because relief workers cannot run the gauntlet of armed gangs roving the city.
President George H.W. Bush, December 4th, 1992. Now Andrew Bacevich, 23-year Army veteran, Boston University history professor. His latest book is Breach of Trust, How Americans Failed Their Soldiers and Their Country. Professor Bacevich, welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you very much for having me on the program.
Can we start with your take on what happened as the Cold War was winding down after the Soviet Union fell? You remind us in the book that prior to 1945, the U.S. had shied away from maintaining a large permanent military establishment. What had the practice been?
Well, the United States had typically relied on citizen soldiers and citizen armies that we raised up in times of emergency, whether the emergency was a desire to invade Mexico and take California or preserve the Union or go fight Kaiser or Bill. The tradition was that once the task for which the Army had been raised was accomplished, then the Army basically was disestablished, and we returned to what was, in fact, a very small peacetime establishment.
What?
During the Cold War, we began to drift away from that habit. The Cold War, as a protracted emergency, persuaded Americans that we needed to maintain a large establishment in what was this kind of quasi-peacetime, quasi-wartime. But I think the big change happens when the Cold War ends, because whether or not the Cold War meant that peace on Earth was going to reign, it certainly offered the United States an opportunity to become a more normal nation with a more modest sense of what our army existed to do. In fact, what happened is that ambitions about what the army could do and should do actually increased in the wake of the Cold War.
You look back on the first Gulf War in 1991, for example, which many people consider the good U.S. invasion of Iraq by the good President Bush. But you suggest that he inflated what was a throwback, stupid invasion of Kuwait by Saddam Hussein into a turning point harbinger of the future, which it wasn't. So how do you look back on the meaning?
In a sense, I think less George Herbert Walker Bush, but the military itself and then Bush's successor, President Bill Clinton. I mean, the way I would tell the story is this, that military power, to the extent that military power worked during the Cold War, and it did, it worked when we viewed our power as aimed to deter and contain. I mean, the most successful U.S. military campaign in all of history was the military campaign to defend Western Europe, beginning in the late 1940s until the Berlin Wall fell. It was a campaign with virtually no casualties. We succeeded in averting World War III. But the kind of a historical accident of the first Persian Gulf War occurring so soon after the fall of the Berlin Wall, persuaded people in Washington that our military strength was so great that we need not restrict ourselves to trying to deter and contain and defend, but that we possessed, this is what we thought back in the 1990s, mm-hmm. we had come into the possession of an instrument for power projection that could bring about positive political change relatively quickly and relatively economically. And I think that thinking very much permeated Washington after 9/11 and led to the notion that waging a global war on terror was a good idea with the invasion of Afghanistan and then the invasion of Iraq as the first two chapters in that global war.
And so the Somalia mission, 1992-93, including the Black Hawk Down incident in which 18 Army Rangers were killed, in the book you write that Somalia, not the first Iraq war, was the real preview of the world to come.
Well,
Why did you put it that way?
I mean, I wish I would have written that back in 1993. I mean, I wish I could have been able to draw that lesson. But in retrospect, it seems clear that here was the warning that a high-tech military force wasn't simply going to go wherever it wanted and win easy victories. Here was the warning that to send American ground soldiers into cities to engage in unconventional conflict was going to produce pretty ugly results. Unfortunately, I think both the Clinton administration back in 93 and the military establishment back in 93, they weren't interested in learning the lessons that Somalia had to teach. They were interested in portraying this as somehow evidence of the superiority of American warriors. So they blinded themselves to what might have been an important learning experience.
And I think we hear that argument for the superiority of American warriors in this clip that we're going to play of President Clinton in October of 93. We heard President Bush in December 92 announcing what was supposed to be a seven-week food delivery mission. Here is President Clinton in October of that next year, just after Black Hawk Down.
When our troops in Somalia came under fire this last weekend, we witnessed a dramatic example of the heroic ethic of our American military. When the first Black Hawk helicopter was down this weekend, the other American troops didn't retreat, although they could have. Some 90 of them formed a perimeter around the helicopter, and they held that ground under intensely heavy fire. They stayed with their comrades. That's the kind of soldiers they are. That's the kind of people we are. So let us finish the work we set out to do. Let us demonstrate to the world, as generations of Americans have done before us, that when Americans take on a challenge, they do their job right.
President Clinton, October 1993. Military historian Andrew Bacevich with us. His new book is called Breach of Trust. So remind us, Professor, how did the U.S. mission expand to that length of time compared to what President Bush had first reportedly intended?
Well, it was decisions made by President Clinton. I mean, President Bush, whether he did it cynically or innocently, handed his successor a great problem by initiating this intervention. And people have forgotten, but President Bush declared that the mission would be complete by January 20th, 1993, when his successor was going to be inaugurated. Now, anybody with an ounce of sense knew that that was not going to be the case. So Clinton inherits this ongoing intervention launched for the purpose of ensuring that starving people could be fed. And Clinton and his advisors basically asked the question, okay, now that the people that are starving are being fed, what do we do? We can leave, but if we leave, then anarchy will once again prevail and we'll have the original problem restored. The alternative, the one that they decided to do, was to create a political order in Somalia so that when the military left, there would be some semblance of stability. It was that decision then, in essence, to intervene in Somali politics, to determine the future of Somalia, that elicited the violent response that ultimately culminates in the Mogadishu firefight. Again, a warning about the limits of what American military power can do, and a warning against this tendency to overreach and to imagine that we can achieve political objectives that aren't realistic.
And a straight line from that, or maybe a very wobbly, jagged line from that to the continued state of failed state in Somalia that led to the rise of al-Shabaab and where we are today?
Well, I think a wavy line, but also other wavy lines that point to today's Iraq, that today's Afghanistan, and the Afghanistan that will exist when we depart. I mean, to my mind, Somalia, Iraq, Afghanistan, they're really all part of a much larger project, never explicitly defined, but a project that assumes that the adroit use of American military power can somehow or other sort out the problems of the greater Middle East, that if we use our power with sufficient determination, that we can stabilize the region, that we can bring democracy to the region, that we can lead the people who live in that part of the world to think better of us. We've been doing that for several decades now. It's not working.
But in the 90s context, I think another aspect of the bigger picture was that there was a certain kind of liberal interventionism post-Cold War that wanted the U.S. military involved to do good, where
yes.
they believed no other institution could do it. You heard
yes.
President Bush about the failure of the U.N. troops to succeed in delivering the food. And in incidents without any obvious U.S. interest at stake, delivering food in Somalia, restoring President Aristide after the coup in Haiti, stopping the Serb assaults in the Balkans, I think conservatives saw that as the military being used as social workers and not for vital U.S. interests, and they didn't like either of those things. How do you look back upon that debate of that era? Is that moot today?
I think it's moot, and the reason I think it's moot is because I think we should not accept at face value the claims that the 90s interventionism was humanitarian in its intent. And let me try to be clear. Humanitarian concerns were part of the rationale, but I don't think they suffice. Let's take the case of the Balkans. I'm persuaded that one of the reasons that we intervened in the Balkans is because this disorder on the southeastern fringe of Europe was calling into question the continued viability of NATO. People were saying, hey, what does NATO exist to do if not to maintain order inside Europe?
Mm.
And to allow NATO to be undermined would, in effect, to call into question our claim to be the leader of Europe. So to some degree, that's not an entire explanation, but to some degree, we intervened in Bosnia and then in Kosovo in order to expand the mission, NATO's mission, and in a sense ensure its continued relevance in a post-Cold
mm-hmm.
War world.
Right. So before you go, I know the largest context of these references in your book is the story of the post-Vietnam, post-draft U.S. military, which you've become very critical of. Is it because most Americans are disconnected from the personal consequences of war?
Well, I think that because we have become disconnected from the political consequences and we've become disconnected from our military itself, that allows people in power in Washington to misuse and abuse the troops. And therefore, the claim that we support the troops, that we respect the troops, we hold the troops in high regard, there's something that doesn't set right with me. In that regard. I mean, if indeed we cared about the troops, then certainly we would act to prevent ill-advised policymakers from undertaking ill-advised policies. And there one could point actually to the Syria debate and the president's backing away from force, at least for now, as perhaps an indication that the American people are waking up to this.
Do you want to return to the draft?
No. What I suggest in the book is that we ought to have a national conversation about a program of national service. And national service really means that every 18-year-old, just to pick an arbitrary age, owes a term of service to country and community, and that some young people could serve that term of service by joining the military for a couple of years. The others would spend a couple of years, you know, in the Peace Corps, working for Teach for America, preserving the environment, and a host of other things. To my mind, that would close the gap between the military and society, perhaps ensure that we have more prudent military policies, but it would also, in a sense, enrich the reigning conception of citizenship by suggesting that citizenship is not simply claiming prerogatives, but it entails obligations and responsibilities to the collective.
Boston University historian Andrew Bacevich, his new book is Breach of Trust, How Americans Failed Their Soldiers and Their Country. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you very much.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Still to come today, we'll play excerpts from the speeches taking place at the UN this morning. So newsworthy. President Obama, the president of Iran to follow him, Secretary General Ban Ki-moon already said there's no military victory possible in Syria, the president of Brazil, who canceled a visit with President Obama because of Edward Snowden's revelations about NSA spying on Brazil. So we'll play some of those speech excerpts. Our election series, 30 Issues in 30 Days, Issue 2, What Role Should Parents Play in Public Education Policy, and more still to come this morning, so stay with us.